since April of 1985. This is the DX Audio Service. National Radio
Club. Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for February 2010. This is issue 299. If you'd like to write to us at the DX Audio Service, the address is 706 Mackenzie Drive, that's spelled Mackenzie, in Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Email is sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $28. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. To subscribe or renew, make a check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using our PayPal credit card system. Or if you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with our PayPal credit card system. You must be able to download and navigate a website to use this service. Well, let's navigate ourselves down to Fort Worth, Texas, where the cowboys are riding, the cattle are mooing, and Bill Hale is here with the AM Switch.
This is the AM Switch.
Thanks, Brett, and welcome everyone to AM Switch for the DX Audio Service for February 2010. Call letter changes, as always, we start out with those. Old call, WPPI 540 in Sauk Rapids, Minnesota, has made the switch to WXYG. On 730 WOHS, Cramerton, North Carolina, their call is WZGV. And if it sounds funny, Cramerton, they've got a CP coming from Shelby, North Carolina on 730. 980 WTIX in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, has made the switch to WEGO. 1090 KBAL, Belleville, Texas, they're now known as KULF. 1310 KXAM, Mesa, Arizona, their letterhead now reads KIHP. 1360, a new station in Lithonia, Georgia, they've chosen the call as WHRH. 1410 WEGO, Concord, North Carolina, they picked up that WTIX call sign from Winston-Salem. In fact, the 980 and the 1410 just switched. And finally, 1520, a new station in Thunderbolt, Georgia, their call WSH. X. Before we get into the actions for this month, let's briefly go over some of those more common antenna codes so we don't have to mention them every time we hear one. U1, that means unlimited time operation, non-directional antenna. U2 means directional at night only. U3, directional all hours with the same pattern. And U4 means unlimited time operation, two different patterns, day and night. Those, of course, are for the full-time stations. Now, a couple that we generally here with daytime stations are D1, meaning they're a daytime station, non-directional, and D3, a daytime station using a directional pattern. Now, of course, if we run across any of those oddball ones, I'll explain them as we go along, okay? Here we go. 770 KCBC, Manteca, California. The CP has been granted to change the city of license from Riverbank and change the facilities to U4, 50,000 watts daytime, 4,100 watts at night, raising the nighttime power. The night pattern is slightly changed with the main lobe headed to the southwest. 910 kilohertz WUBR, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They're now on with U4, 1,200 watts during the day and 51 watts at night. Also on 910 WSBA, York, Pennsylvania, an STA, meaning Special Temporary Authority, has been granted for an extension for 1,250 watts days, 250 watts at night, U1, as construction continues on the CP of WGLD 1440 as they're diplexing with the WSBA and moving from Red Lion to Manchester Township. 920 WURA, Quantico, Virginia. New station is now on with U4, 7,000 watts during the day, 970 watts at night from three towers. The day pattern shoots a large circular lobe to the northeast, which should cover Washington and Baltimore nicely, with a smaller lobe to the southwest, While the night pattern sends a similar pattern to the southeast with very minor lobes to the southwest, northwest, and northeast. 1230 KSIX Corpus Christi, Texas is now on with 720 watts day and night U1 from a taller tower, thus the decrease in power from 1 kilowatt. 1260 KBSZ Apache Junction, Arizona. The CP has been granted for U1 800 watts days, 50 watts at night, moving from Wickenburg on 1250. 1270 CFGT Alma, Quebec. They've been granted a move to 104.5 megahertz. 1310 KSET Lumberton, Texas. They're licensed for 500 watts daytime only, non-directional at Silsby. KSET was granted a CP for U4, 1500 days, 270 watts at Lumberton. They then filed for and were granted 2000 watts days, 270 watts at night U4. Now they've been granted a special temporary authority for U4, 1500 watts days, 270 watts at night, while they revert from their proposed above ground elevated ground system and revert to the conventional system with buried radials. 1340 CKCR Revelstoke, BC. The FM station on 106.1 is now on the air, meaning the 1340 facility has less than 90 days of life. 1370 KRAC Quincy, California. Licensed for U4, 5,000 days, 500 nights, KRAC has been silent since December 26th of 2008 due to vandalism of the phaser system of their two-tower array. They've now been granted an STA to return to the air with U1, 1,000 watts days, 125 watts at night, so as not to lose their license because of the FCC's one-year silent and you're out rule. 1390 WADA Shelby, North Carolina, a CP has been granted for U1, 1400 watts days, 16 watts at night, moving the transmitter site about 3 miles to that of WZGV 730. 1450 KIKR Beaumont, Texas, a construction permit has been granted to build a new replacement tower at the base of the old one and remain U1. 1,000 days, 1,000 nights. The new tower will be approximately one-half as tall as the original structure. And finally, 1490 KNAM Silt, Colorado. That new station is now on with 740 watts day and night U1 using a 75-foot Valcom flagpole-type antenna. Well, grants for new stations, 1450 Glenwood Springs, Colorado. They've been granted U1 300 watts day and night. And, of course, that's non-directional. Applications for new stations, 1180, Orchard Homes, Montana. They've applied for 10,000 watts during the day, 500 watts at night, U2. Orchard Homes is located at Missoula. And 1490, Lamont, Pennsylvania. They've applied for 1,000 watts during the day, 270 watts at night, U1. Lamont is in northeast Pennsylvania, south of Kane. Well, one of our newer categories that's getting a lot of paper lately, AM on FM. A lot of stations have gone back to the, you remember years ago? They all used to simulcast, and then they broke away. Now they're getting back together. Anyway, here's our list this month. Some of these are full-powered stations, and some are translators. You can tell the translators because they've got numbers in the call letters. 620 WZON Bangor, Maine is on WZON FM 103.1 in Bangor. 630 WEJL Scranton, Pennsylvania. They're on translator W274AO, which is 102.7. 640 WOI Ames, Iowa. They're relayed on KWOI 90.7 in Carroll. 710 KURV Edinburgh, Texas. They're on KZSP 95.3 South Padre Island. 950 WVTS Charleston, West Virginia. They're also heard on WZJO 94.5 in Dunbar. 1050 WBNC Conway, New Hampshire. They're heard on W237BX 95.3 North Conway. 1070 WSCP Sandy Creek, Pulaski, New York. They're being simulcast on WTKW 99.5 in Bridgeport. 1150 WTMP Egypt Lake, Florida. They can be heard on WTMP-FM 96.1, Dade City. Also on 1150 KOLJ, Quanah, Texas, they're heard on K254BJ 98.7 in Quanah. 1240 WJLX, Jasper, Alabama, They're carried on W268 BM 101.9 in Jasper. 1240 KXIT Delhart, Texas. They're heard on K233 BY 94.5 in Delhart. 1290 WATO Oak Ridge, Tennessee. They're translated on W266 AM 101.1 in Oak Ridge. 1320 WLOH Lancaster, Ohio. They're heard on W283 BO 104.5 in Lancaster. 1340 KSSR Santa Rosa, New Mexico. They're simulcast on KKJY 95.9 in Santa Rosa. 1410 KNVR San Saba, Texas. They're heard on KNUZ 106.1 San Saba. 1440 WFNY Gloversville, New York. They're translated on W231 CF 94.1 in Gloversville. 1460 WGMF Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania. They're heard on W283 BJ 104.5 in Exeter. 1510 KCTX Childress, Texas. They're translated on K220 JC 89.9 in Childress. 1540 WMYJ Martinsville, Indiana. They're heard on W232 BZ 94.3 in Martinsville. 1540 WBRY Woodbury, Tennessee. They're heard on W224 CJ 96.7 in Woodbury. 1600 WAMS Dover, Delaware. They're heard on two translators, W252 CH 98.3 in Dover and on W286 BS 105.1 in Milford, Delaware. And 1600 WKFO Corbin, Kentucky. They're being heard on translator station W253 BC 98.5 in North Corbin. Stations which have returned to the airwaves over the past 30 days include WEBC 560 Duluth, Minnesota. They were off for about 3 days because water was leaking into the transmitter building. The station was first noted off the air December 24th, but they were back on 3 days later. WIZR 930 Johnstown, New York. We suspect this is only to keep the license active for another year. It will likely be silent again. WCOC 1010 Cora, Alabama is back on, as is WCSP 1070 Sandy Creek, Pulaski, New York. WPBQ 1240 Flowood, Mississippi is back with the talk format. KSET 1300 Lumberton, Texas also with talk. And WVZN 1580 Columbia, Pennsylvania returns to the air with Spanish Contemporary Christian. Reported as silent, and we've got quite a list of those. KXOR Junction City, Oregon on 660. KXGM 850 Waterloo, Iowa. KXPD 1040 Tigard, Oregon. Also off, KAGO 1150 Klamath Falls, Oregon. KMFX 1190 Wabasha, Minnesota. WIPS 1250 Ticonderoga, New York. WTJH 1260 East Point, Georgia. WBBK 1260 Blakely, Georgia. WYXC 1270 Cartersville, Georgia. WCVG 1320 Covington, Kentucky. WOYL 1340 Oil City, Pennsylvania because of transmitter failure. WOAM 1350 Peoria, Illinois. WBYE 1370 Calera, Alabama. WOBG 1400 Clarksburg, West Virginia. WROB 1450 West Point, Mississippi. KLZS 1450 Eugene, Oregon. WPNT 1490 South Bend, Indiana. And WRCE 1490 Watkins Glen, New York is silent after a tower collapse. A crew was working on their 400-foot tower when the 40-year-old structure collapsed. Sadly, one worker was killed. A silent STA has been submitted. Also off, police in Greenville County, South Carolina are investigating the theft of broadcast equipment from WCSZ 1070. The station has been silent for some time, and authorities believe the theft may have occurred sometime between November 16th and December 16th. Among the items taken include the station's transmitter, transmitter tubes, and studio control board, all valued at $106,000. Police say the theft was discovered when a company employee noticed an open gate to the property and an open window on the building, which is not checked regularly. Well, KMFX 1190 Wabasha, Minnesota is off again, as we just mentioned. Clear Channel Communications first took the station off the air on January 10, 2008 for financial reasons and put the station up for sale. According to FCC filings, the station has been off and on the air since then and most recently went silent December 9th. In July, Clear Channel announced plans to donate the station to the Minority Media and Telecommunications Council, but at our deadline, the license has not yet been transferred. Well, WXYC 1270 Cartersville, Georgia experienced what they call a catastrophic equipment failure. After sizing up the expense to make all the necessary repairs, management has pulled the plug, stating, and we quote, "We cannot justify the expense in equipment and labor to put the station back on the air at this time." For the past 5 years, the station owners say they have not taken salary or compensation so as to keep the station afloat. The closing of WYXC puts their morning host out of work. Syndicated talkers Glenn Beck and Laura Ingram, among others, are losing this Northwest Georgia affiliate. However, it was reported at Deadline that they had returned to the air, so stay tuned. One fine to report this month, a fine of $17,500 has been assessed to KRAL 1240 Rawlins, Wyoming, along with their FM station, for failing to ensure the operational readiness of their emergency alert system equipment, for failing to maintain a complete public inspection file, and for failing to operate station WHB 734, which is an oral studio-to-transmitter link, from its licensed location. Well, that's about it for this month. My thanks go out to Sean Axelrod, Ken Chatterton, Bruce Elving, Wayne Heinen, Richard Lawhead, Tim Noonan, Dave Schmidt, and some notes from Upper Midwest Broadcasting on the Internet. Back to you, Fred. We'll see everybody next month.
Thanks, Bill. Hey, we're still waiting for information concerning the 2010 National Radio Club Convention, which I understand is going to be held in Rochester, New York. So as soon as we get the details on that, I'll pass it on to you. However, John Adams of Seaside, Oregon, a DX Audio Service member, related this information that the 2010 IRCA Convention, that's the International Radio Club of America, is going to be held right there in his hometown of Seaside, Oregon, the weekend of September the 24th through the 26th. You can contact Pat Martin for more information on the convention or send your questions right here to the DX Audio Service and I'll pass them on to Pat. Remember, that's the weekend of September 24th through the 26th in Seaside, Oregon for the 2010 IRCA Convention. Now let's go up to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and here is Mark Dernberger.
We're coming into February, and some of us have already let our New Year's resolutions start to slide. Mine was the usual. I'm not doing real well with the weight loss. Too much time in front of the computer, I guess. But we've got a lot of work to do, and one of the early projects this year is to respond to your requests for information on the hourly time tones used by most radio stations in the past, but only by a few in recent times. Well, during research for this project, I came across the history of WWV, the National Bureau of Standards Time Station, and I thought we'd spend our time this month learning about how WWV came about. Because, you see, they turn out to be one of the claimants as the first broadcasting station. Turns out to be not quite correct, but they did precede KDKA and some others. Let's let the historians at WWV tell the story. This information is taken from NIST Special Publication 250-67. WWV has a long and storied history that dates back to the early days of radio broadcasting. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, has been involved with radio and radio frequency research almost from its founding in 1901. Scientists at the National Bureau of Standards, NBS as it was then known, began research in radio frequency propagation as early as 1905. During World War I, NBS had established its radio section, which worked closely with the military to research and develop radio techniques for defense and navigation. The radio station call letters WWV were assigned to NBS in October 1919. Although the call letters WWV are now synonymous with the broadcasting of time signals, it's unknown why those particular call letters were chosen or were assigned. Testing of the station began from Washington, D.C. in May 1920 with the broadcast of Friday evening music concerts that lasted from 8:30 to 11 p.m. The 50-watt transmissions used a wavelength of 500 meters, about 600 kilohertz, and they could be heard about 40 kilometers away from the station. A news release dated May 28, 1920, hinted at the significance of this event. This means that music can be performed at any place, radiated into the air by means of an ordinary radio set, and received at any other place, even though hundreds of miles away. The music received can be made as loud as described by suitable operation of the receiving apparatus. Such concerts are sometimes sent out by the radio laboratory of the Bureau of Standards in connection with trials of experimental apparatus. This music can be heard by anyone in the states near the District of Columbia having a simple amateur receiving outfit. The pleasant evenings which have been experienced by persons at a number of such receiving stations suggest interesting possibilities of the future. These early experimental musical broadcasts preceded all commercial broadcast stations by about 6 months. KDKA of Pittsburgh, generally acknowledged as the first commercial broadcast station, did not go on the air until November 2, 1920. On December 15, 1920, WWV began assisting the Department of Agriculture in the distribution of market news to farm bureaus and agricultural organizations. A 2-kilowatt spark transmitter and telegraphic code was used to broadcast 500-word reports called the Daily Market Marketgram on 750 kilohertz. The operating radius was about 300 kilometers out of Washington. These broadcasts continued until April 15, 1921. By December 1922, it was decided that the station's purpose would be the transmission of standard frequency signals to be used as a reference standard for other radio broadcasters. The first tests of WWV as a standard frequency station were conducted on January 29th of 1923 and included the broadcast of frequencies from 200 to 545 kHz. By March of 1923, WWV was broadcasting frequencies from 125 to 2,000 kHz on a monthly or weekly schedule. The accuracy of the transmitted frequency was quoted as being better than 0.3%. The output power of the station was now 1,000 watts. During the early days of the WWV broadcasts, the transmitter was adjusted to the correct frequency using a working standard wave meter, which had earlier been checked against the national standard wave meter. The first quartz oscillators were developed shortly before WWV went on the air and soon replaced the wave meter as a national standard of frequency. By 1927, a 50 kilohertz temperature-controlled quartz oscillator was located at the station site and used as the standard of generation. The quartz oscillator made it possible for WWV to meet the needs of the broadcast industry, which desperately needed a reliable reference standard for frequency. The number of radio stations was rapidly increasing across the United States, and it was essential for all stations to stay near their assigned frequencies so that stations would not interfere with each other, keeping the airwaves usable. By 1928, the Federal Radio Commission was calling for all stations to stay within 500 hertz or 500 cycles of their assigned frequency. This prompted J.H. Dellinger, then chief of the radio section of NBS, to write, "While an accuracy of 0.5% was satisfactory 5 years ago, it is now necessary to give consideration to accuracies 1,000 times as good. It is not merely a question of measurement. Frequencies of transmitting stations must actually be held constant with very great accuracy. This is becoming more and more important as the available radio channels become saturated. The maximum number of communications can be packed into the radio spectrum only if each stays within its own channel, as any wandering due to inaccurate frequency adjustment causes interference with communication on the adjacent channel." WWV was able to respond to the needs of the radio industry as improvements in quartz oscillator technology and improved measurement techniques made the transmitted uncertainty of WWV decrease from parts per thousand to parts per million by 1931. However, WWV also faced the problem of an inability to cover the entire United States, since for the most part its signals did not reach the area west of the Mississippi. To address this problem, a list of other broadcast stations found to be suitable as frequency references was maintained by the Bureau. The frequencies of these stations were measured by NBS, and the list was published monthly in the Radio Service Bulletin. NBS also sponsored and helped control other standard frequency broadcasts. Stanford University's radio station 6XBM transmitted standard frequencies for the West Coast from September 1924 to June 1926, and frequencies of value to radio amateurs were sent from station 1XM of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and station 9XL of the Gold Medal Flower Company in Minneapolis. Since other well-operated stations were available as frequency references, an announcement was made in 1926 that WWV might be turned off. However, many commercial, government, and private users responded asking that the WWV broadcasts be continued and improved. Standard frequency broadcasts were discontinued at 6XBM, and it was decided that only one frequency, 5 MHz, would be broadcast by WWV using a new approach. Broadcasts on 5 MHz, controlled by Precision Quartz Oscillators, began from College Park, Maryland, in January 1931, from a new 150-watt transmitter. The 5 MHz frequency was chosen for several reasons, including its usual lack of skip distance and comparatively wide coverage. The transmission schedule varied, but for a time it was every Tuesday for 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night. Within a year, the power was increased to 1,000 watts, and the stability was further enhanced. Until September 1931, less accurate broadcasts were made once per month on other frequencies, but by 1932, it was clear that the 5 MHz station had become part of the national infrastructure, and so work began on making those signals accessible to more Americans by relocating the station and designing new transmitters and antennas in order to increase the coverage area. The station was moved in December 1932 to a Department of Agriculture site near Beltsville, Maryland. By April 1933, the station was broadcasting 30 kilowatts at 5 MHz and added 10 and 15 MHz broadcasts at 20 kilowatts output power. By this time, the station frequency was controlled even more tightly. In June 1937, standard musical instrument pitches, A440, one-second pulses, and standard time intervals, as well as ionosphere bulletins, were added to the broadcast. The 15 MHz carrier was replaced by a 20 MHz transmission, although 15 MHz was restored in May 1940. A fire of undetermined origin destroyed the station on November 6, 1940, but the standard frequency equipment was salvaged and the station returned to the air just 5 days later. An act of Congress in July 1941 provided money for the construction of a new station, which was built south of the former site and went on the air in January 1943. This new location was to remain the home of WWV until December 1966. Although in 1961, the location name for the broadcast was changed from Beltsville to Greenbelt, Maryland. The new station broadcast 5 MHz and 10 MHz continuously and 15 MHz signals during the day only. The radiated output power ranged from 8 to 10 kilowatts. Evening broadcasts at 2.5 kHz were added in February 1944 from a 1,000-watt transmitter. By now, well established as a reference source for frequency and time interval, WWV was still not used as a time synchronization source. This changed in June 1944, when the superintendent of the United States Naval Observatory authorized the synchronization of the WWV time signals with those of the U.S. Naval Observatory. In October 1945, the station added time announcements in Eastern Standard Time in telegraphic code, given every 5 minutes. In December 1946, 4 new carrier frequencies were added, 20, 25, 30, and 35 MHz. The station was now broadcasting continuously on 7 different frequencies both day and night, and from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. on 2.5 MHz. Voice announcements of time, probably WWV's best-known feature, began on January 1, 1950, helping to usher in the second half of the 20th century. The voice announcements were given every 5 minutes. Standard frequencies of 600 and 440 Hz were broadcast during alternating minutes. The 30 and 35 megahertz broadcasts were discontinued in 1953, and the 25 megahertz broadcast was stopped in 1977. With the exception of an almost 2-year interruption in 1977 and 78, the 20 megahertz broadcasts have continued to the present day. Geophysical alert messages began in July 1957, and as quartz oscillator technology continued to improve, so did the frequency control of the broadcast. An experimental time code containing year, month, day, and precise time of day began in April 1960 and was made part of the regular broadcast in January 1961. This time code was believed to be the first digital time code broadcast in the United States. It made it possible for the first time for self-setting radio-controlled clocks to appear. The telegraphic time code was also permanently removed at this time in 1961. In 1966, WWV was moved to its current location near Fort Collins, Colorado. The low-frequency station WWVB had gone on the air in July 1963 near Fort Collins, and it was decided that WWV would share the same 390-acre site. On December 1, 1966, the station in Greenbelt, Maryland went off the air, and the new station simultaneously went on the air in Fort Collins. The current site is about 80 kilometers from the Boulder Laboratories, where the national standards of time and frequency are kept. In April 1967, WWV began broadcasting Greenwich Mean Time, GMT, instead of local time, and began its current format of using Coordinated Universal Time in January 1974. The time announcements were now made every minute instead of every 5 minutes, beginning on July 1, 1971, the same date when the current form of the digital time code was added. The station broadcast the first leap second in history in June of 1972. On August 13, 1991, WWV began broadcasting voice recordings that were digitized and stored in solid-state memory devices. Previous voice recordings had been played back from mechanical drum recorders, which were more prone to failure. The change in equipment required the voice of the announcer to be changed. Don Elliott Heald is believed to have been the original voice of WWV when announcements of time began in 1950. His voice was used until August 13, 1991, when the voice equipment was changed. For a short time, the voice of John Doyle was used for the time announcements. However, the station received a number of complaints that Mr. Doyle's voice was significantly different from Mr. Elliott's, a voice, after all, that had been associated with timekeeping for some 40 years. As a result, the voice was changed to that of Lee Rogers, who remains the current announcer. Mr. Rogers' voice was chosen since it was close to the voice of Mr. Elliott, and WWV's many listeners seemed to be happy with the change. The station has undergone a number of equipment and maintenance changes in recent years, but the broadcast format of the station has remained essentially unchanged since 1991, when the year information was added to the time code and the daylight savings time notification was improved. And that's from the NIST bulletin, The History of WWV. Well, some of you, dear listeners, may cry for a bit more information on this unique broadcast operation, so next month we'll bring you the story of WWVH, broadcasting from the island of Maui in Hawaii. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. Keep your timepieces calibrated, and in about 30 days, or perhaps I should say exactly 30 days, we'll return to this same broadcast. Until then, good listening, DXers.
Thank you, Mr. Dernberger. Now let's turn our attention to the Courtesy Programs Committee, the CPC. A lot of people have been asking, what about all those tests? Well, we've kind of had the CPC go into hibernation, and one of our National Radio Club members, Saul Chernos, up in Canada, has decided to take the bull by the horns and face the situation, and he is going to revive the program. He's the man with the plan. Let's give a listen to what he's got planned for us.
Welcome to what we hope will be a semi-regular feature. We have undertaken to revive the DX Test Committee, a joint venture of IRCA and NRC, with a view to encouraging more stations to run special tests or to let us know in advance when they will be working on their facilities. It seems lately that DX tests have gone the way of the QSL. They used to be a relatively common event, yet fewer and fewer stations are participating. We used to enjoy several tests in a given month at their peak. Now we're lucky to get one or two a year. We'd like to see more tests. For starters, tests are an opportunity to log new stations, say daytimers running at night, or 24-hour station running daytime power and pattern during the witching hour. More tests will also complement other deliberate and thoughtful efforts to revive and maintain interest in the DX hobby at a time when conventional radio's days seem numbered. Witness all the efforts to promote ultralight radios, $50 marvels that, even without modifications, have tremendous nulling capabilities and can pick up stations thousands of miles away. Tests generally run between midnight and 6 a.m. local time, when broadcast regulators allow testing and other related activity to take place. We don't recommend abusing this privilege, for example, running on day power and pattern on multiple consecutive nights. Once a year, or whenever a station needs to tweak its technical facilities, will do quite well enough. Content can vary, but tests intended for DX reception generally include Morse code IDs, sound effects such as sweep tones, and an eclectic mix of music, say, high school marching bands or the wild sounds of the klezmer. In other words, material that helps the station stand out from others on the same frequency. Morse code and sweep tones are particularly effective at cutting through a crowded channel. Even graveyarders, local stations on frequencies such as 1230 and 1400 have been heard at great distances through DX tests. Stations should also run DX tests using their daytime transmitter pattern and power. Otherwise, they're really doing nothing much out of the ordinary. Now, DX tests do not magically appear. They happen through the concerted effort of volunteers like you, who contact the stations and ask for them. If you know an engineer, program director, or owner at a particular station, why not ask? Perhaps you are the engineer, program director, or owner. Or if you've received a particularly friendly QSL, the worst that can happen is you'll be turned down. Well, that's no big deal. Just move on and ask another station. Somebody somewhere will eventually say yes if you persist in your efforts and make a conscious effort to smile even when you're trying to send an email or making the phone call. When a station agrees to test, let us know so that we can notify DXers around the world. Contact at the address that I've given. If you're not yet sure how to make your query, or if your station contact isn't familiar with running a DX test, we're here to help. We can provide you with a generic sample letter, which you can adapt to suit your station target. We can even provide sound effects and weird music. We might add that if you hear in advance of a station planning to go off the air to do transmitter work, please let us know as soon as possible. A station briefly vacating a channel also represents an opportunity to hear stations that would normally be obscured. Furthermore, consider asking the station to run some Morse code, sweep tones, or other DX test material for a few minutes when they're doing their work or returning to the airwaves. Please keep in mind that the more advance notice you can provide, the better able we will be to pass the word along through DX Club paper bulletins and through the DX audio service. Unfortunately, not every DXer has internet access. Those of you who do not have computers might consider setting up a Hotmail or Yahoo account and using a computer at your local library. You'll get lots of good DX tips by subscribing to the many alert and discussion lists that are out there. So here's a New Year's challenge. If each of you reading or hearing this message contacts one station, well, can you imagine a lot of very, very happy DXers? To help, this column will appear periodically in the paper bulletins of both clubs and also on the DX audio service and online where appropriate. Please feel free to email any feedback and suggestions to our committee at dxtests@bell.net. That's dxtests@bell.net. Or to log on to dxtests.info@gmail.com. to see what tests have been scheduled, and to learn more. The web address, again, dxtests, dxtests, info@gmail.com. That's gmail.com. You are also welcome to phone the DX Tests Committee. The phone number is 416-364-0725. 73's Saul Chernos, S-A-U-L-C-H-E-R-N-O-S. Thank you. Signing off.
Thanks, Saul, and let's hope we can get some DX tests scheduled for this 2010 DX season. I know I could use a few tests in my logbook. Well, Crazy Ken is doing some remodeling at his plush little cabin located in upstate New York, and he says he found a few tapes, which apparently the mice must have got a hold of and dragged into a little cubbyhole, because he just found them this past week. And here's the deal. We're trying to get out of the old tape business. We only give you back issues for the previous DX Audio Service year. So anything that's after dark, anything prior to December of 2007, when it's gone, it's gone. So this is your last chance to get any of these programs at a very, very reduced price. By the way, the price that I'm going to give you is post-paid. So not only you get the tapes and the binders, but you also get the postage included in the cost. Here we go. After Dark Volume 2. This is Air Checks from such rarities as WNRC in its early years, and the 1984 IRCA convention radio station WTCL on 830 in Toledo, Ohio, as well as Laser 558 and much more from broadcast band, FM, and shortwave stations. Four cassettes in a binder for $5. After Dark Volume 3. This contains an interview with Radio Netherlands' Jonathan Marks, host of Media Network, an interview with Dr. Bruce Elving, who is the editor of the FM Atlas, a complete Las Vegas, Nevada band scan. Also, the inaugural broadcast from WWTC in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with their all-kids Radio Oz format, Chicago's Voices in the Night, and a few other columns as well. Four cassettes in a binder, $5. After Dark Volume 4, DX Audio Service featuring the interview with Wolfman Jack. This was an interview that I conducted with Wolfman Jack just prior to his passing. There's also a walking tour of WWV featuring Mindy Dreyer. Also an exclusive interview with AM stereo pioneer Leonard Kahn. And two successful blind DJs relate their experiences in radio. Four cassettes in a binder for $5. After Dark Volume 5. This was a big one, as you'll find out, featuring an in-depth interview with VOA's John Vodnik on the closing of the Bethany, Ohio transmitter site in 1991. Air checks from 1230 and 1240 stations. Also, an interview with Mark Connolly and Bruce Conti on TA DXing, and many, many more items. 12 cassettes in a binder for $15. After Dark Number 6, four 90-minute cassettes in a plastic album, a look at talk radio, the 1340 kilohertz travelogue, Battle of the Century, the WJY story from radio's early days, interviews on scanning and long-wave DXing, sports radio and a history of radio and sports, and a whole lot more. Four cassettes in a binder for $5. After Dark Volume 7, four 90-minute cassettes in a plastic binder, stories of KVET Austin, Texas, and WJJD in Chicago, Illinois, pirate radio in the United States, Captain Flintstone is grounded. International DX Report, broadcast pioneers by states, and more. Four cassettes in a binder, $5. Assignment Air Check. This was Volume 4. Country and Western stations. Air checks from these are air checks sent in by various DX Audio Service members. Two cassettes in individual boxes, only $4. Finally, All Radio 3, I talked with engineer and author Barry McLarnon about digital radio, IBOC, and we show examples of the adjacent channel interference that many DXers have talked about. This informative interview goes into great detail about IBOC and the DXer's standpoint. It's a CD, and there's only a few left at $4. There you go. If you'd like to score some tapes for the last time, just contact us here at the DX Audio Service or contact Wayne Heinen at the Publication Center. Address will be on side two.
At this time, please turn over your tape to side two.